and so to Italy. What if scientists warn that a hurricane is about to devastate New York City and New Jersey? Are they responsible for causing a mass evacuation? And what if the hurricane turns out to be only a heavy shower? And what about climate warnings and the long-term turbulence that's causing? And what if it's not so severe a change? And earthquake? The scientists say it's likely, but are they legally responsible for doing so? Corinne Podger goes to Italy.
In early 2009, regular tremors began shaking the central Italian region of Abruzzo. Residents of the regional capital, L'Aquila, were worried. Many of the city's picturesque buildings were centuries old, and there were more than 70,000 inhabitants to think of. The central government's major risk committee launched an evaluation of the increased seismic activity. At a meeting on the 31st of March 2009, they concluded there were no grounds for believing a major quake was on the way. Later that day, committee member Bernardo Di Bernardinis, vice president of Italy's Civil Protection Department, gave a TV interview to reassure the public.
Eravamo presenti come protezione civile nazionale e regionale a fianco ai sindaci, quindi nell'affrontare e tranquillizzare la popolazione.
Mr. Di Bernardinis told the journalists he wanted to reassure people. The scientific community tells me there is no danger, he says, because there is an ongoing discharge of energy. The situation looks favorable.
Senz'altro normale dal punto di vista.
It's normale, or normal. 6 days later, Abruzzo was hit by a 6.3 magnitude earthquake, the brunt of it borne by L'Aquila.
Mazza, tirati su. Eh? Chi è?
Terremoto.
Terremoto.
Terremoto, ah.
Alle 3.32 di questa notte un forte terremoto di magnitudo 5.8 della scala Richter ha colpito l'Abruzzo, con epicentro L'Aquila.
Thousands of buildings were destroyed or badly damaged. At least 30,000 people lost their homes. And 308 people died, including 20 children. One of those children was the daughter of L'Aquila-based GP, Vincenzo Vittorini.
Regrettably, I was at home with my wife and my daughter. I have another child, a boy, who saved himself because he was on a school excursion. And sadly, when there was the very violent tremor, my house collapsed totally. We remained buried for many hours, and then they pulled me out alive from the building, but my wife and my daughter are no longer with us.
Many accused the Major Risk Committee of giving L'Aquila's residents a false sense of security, depriving them of the chance to move to safety.
Before and after the meeting of the High Risk Committee, the messages that came out of the committee were ones of reassurance. So on the basis of those reassurances, the majority of people remained at home. No one abandoned their home. That night, we were all indoors. Perhaps, I'm not suggesting they should have created alarm, but they should have made us alert. They should have said, be careful. If they had, perhaps someone would have made different decisions after the tremors that preceded on that night the destructive quake. We would probably have left our homes. Instead, they were telling us that the more quakes there were, the more they were discharging energy, and it was all for the best, something that was absolutely not true. They underestimated a risk which could have been properly assessed. And this is what the Italian judges will have to decide if there was something that didn't work.
Thomas Jordan heads the Southern California Earthquake Center. After the L'Aquila quake, he chaired an international commission of inquiry into earthquake forecasting in Italy. Professor Jordan says on March 31st, there was a slight increase in the risk of a major quake, but only of around 1%, not enough to justify mass evacuations. And at the same time, the Italian geoscientists felt they needed to play down public speculation about potential risks. Professor Jordan says Mr. Di Bernardinis tried to convey that complexity in his TV interview and essentially failed.
There were people, not seismological authorities, but let's call them amateurs, that were making statements of predictions about large earthquakes, and people were confused about what the situation was. So to some extent, they were trying to calm the fears about a major earthquake, you have to realize that these types of sequences of earthquakes, it was what we call a seismic swarm, which was occurring at that time and was the cause for concern, is very common in Italy. And most of those are not accompanied by a major earthquake. So based on statistics, you would say chances are nothing's going to happen now. That is, in fact, a correct statement. Unfortunately, a large earthquake did occur, and people felt that the authorities had called that one wrong. So they're kind of in a bind. Do you emphasize the fact that the probability of having a large earthquake is low, or do you emphasize that the probability of having an earthquake is higher than it normally would be?
Now, from the residents' point of view, they were getting scientific advice, albeit in the form of a television interview, and on that basis they stayed in their homes and more than 300 people died. Do they have a right to seek redress?
Of course, that kind of feeling is understandable after a loss such as this one, but if one looks at the details of this particular case, my view is that the charges that the prosecution have raised have no merit with respect to the actions of the scientists involved. The problem is how people hear statements like that and how they act on them.
But that's not how the Italian judiciary saw things. Last year, in response to public complaints, the geoscientists were placed under formal investigation for gross negligent manslaughter. And this year it was announced they would stand trial. The news appalled scientists around the world. More than 3,000 geoscientists signed an open letter to Prime Minister Silvio Berlusconi, demanding the investigation be dropped. The chief executive of the American Association for the Advancement of Science, Alan Leshner, wrote directly to the Italian authorities with the same request, to no avail.
We got no response. And frankly, though, we didn't expect a response. We made our statement in order to be very clear with the Italian government that, in fact, scientists aren't able to predict with the level of accuracy that they are after the fact demanding, and therefore they should not be held liable for deaths or other kinds of destruction that's occurred.
But they may be found liable in court. Judge Giuseppe Romano Gargarella has accused the group of supplying imprecise, incomplete and contradictory information and of thwarting activities designed to protect the public. A lawyer for one of the defendants has indicated they'll plead not guilty, but says he fears the trial could drag on for more than a year. Professor Leshner worries the case could intimidate other geoscientists or indeed any researcher whose job involves communicating risk.
The concern is that it's, of course, impossible to predict earthquakes with any great precision, and holding scientists responsible for something they not only can't control but can't predict with great accuracy misrepresents the nature of science and the nature of scientific prediction, and therefore runs the risk of throwing scientists into all kinds of potentially libelous circumstances. When scientists hear about instances like this, where they could be held liable in a criminal sense for making statements based on their scientific understanding, it understandably will intimidate them to the degree that they will become far more reluctant to make statements in public. And I think that's fully understandable.
L'Aquila survivor Vincenzo Vittorini says he knows scientists can't predict earthquakes, but he says someone should be held accountable for the way the risk of a quake was explained to L'Aquila's residents, many of whom he feels lost their lives because they put their trust in science.
Now listen, everyone is saying that this is a trial against science, that it is a trial against men for not knowing how to guess the time of the earthquake, a trial against men who didn't evacuate an entire city. But here it's neither a trial against science, nor is it a trial against people for not guessing that an earthquake would hit. We all know very well that earthquakes can't be predicted. But knowing all of the characteristics of our city, in other words, that it is a city which, from an historical point of view, sees destructive earthquakes, that there is a series of active faults, that there is a level of acceleration under the town centre of L'Aquila, equivalent to 10 times the size of the quake, that L'Aquila is built with fragile buildings, and while knowing all of this, nothing was told to the population. That is what we criticise, that they didn't say to the population that we were living and are still living on a bomb. Now we know that and we can behave accordingly. Before we knew that, in L'Aquila, earthquakes would hit systematically, but we didn't know the seriousness of the problem.
problema.
In the wake of the L'Aquila disaster, Professor Thomas Jordan's International Commission of Inquiry made a range of recommendations on communicating earthquake risk more effectively. But he says implementing those recommendations has been a slow process, and not just in Italy.
We did evaluate techniques for forecasting earthquakes in the long term and also the short term, and made recommendations about how that information should be gathered and distributed to the public, not just during seismic crises, but also during times when not much is happening, so that they understand how the hazard and the risks are changing when something unusual does happen. And that particular way of communicating information is called operational earthquake forecasting, and we recommended that better systems be put into place.
And have they?
Now, in fact, yes, there certainly is a lot of work towards that. We actually did a global study, or a study of many seismically active countries, to see how they handled similar situations. And what we found was that basically no country is doing things, let's say, better than Italy. There are not systems to provide the types of public information that our commission thought should be provided to the public, and we recommended that those systems be put into place. And I think the Italians will probably do that. I think other countries, such as here in the United States, are going to develop operational forecasting systems to provide better information to people.
What is your view of this case going to trial in Italy?
I was disappointed that the judicial review mandated a trial. In my reading of what happened, although it's a very complex situation, the scientists, as far as I can tell, acted in very good faith. They were trying to communicate as best they could the limited information that they had in the face of a lot of public concern. One can always criticize after the fact that they should have said things slightly differently or behaved in a different manner, but the scientists under indictment didn't say anything that was scientifically incorrect, as far as I can tell. Given that, I don't see the basis for why this prosecution is going forward. You know, the public want to have information about risks that they face that is authoritative, it's scientific, it's got to be timely, and it's got to be consistent. And I think the public has become very demanding in this regard, and we need to, as scientists, help governments develop better systems for delivering this information.
David Spiegelhalter is professor for the public understanding of risk at Cambridge University in Britain. He says the Italian case will be closely watched by scientists engaged in calculating probabilities of all kinds, from climate change and flood prediction to insurance and medicine.
Well, it certainly made me very cautious. I've worked, for example, on working out the risks of Icelandic volcanoes erupting and them closing airspace. And, you know, clearly one does one's best using the available data, some of it going back 1,000 years. But you still, you know, all you can do in the end is give a chance of something happening. I don't think it really should intimidate scientists if essentially they stick to their jobs, you know, which is working out a reasonable assessment of what the odds are of something bad happening over the next year, 2 years, or even over the next week. The problem comes when it's communicated and if that's not handled in a decent way. So I'd be very concerned if I was a scientist and I thought that what I was doing was then going to be discussed in a rather casual way to either the press or the public, because it's so easy for people to get the wrong end of the message, to rather carefully hone scientific statement about the uncertainty to be misinterpreted in a very reassuring way, as seems to have been done in this instance.
We are now starting to see some analyses of the Japanese earthquake and tsunami appearing in the scientific journals, not just of the earthquake itself, but of the risk of radiation exposure from the damage the disaster caused at Fukushima, the social and economic cost of evacuating thousands of people and maintaining the exclusion zone. There's an awful lot riding on the work of scientists engaged in risk prediction in terms of the decisions people take as a result. Is it too much pressure?
Well, there is a lot of pressure, but again, they should be really clear about what the duties are of a scientist assessing the risks. The scientist, it's not their duty to decide whether someone should be evacuated or not. It's their duty is to establish what the exposures might be and what the risks might be to future health. It's actually a political decision deciding what should be done with that information. And you need a clear distinction between those responsibilities. And it's when that distinction gets blurred that you get, I think, the problems coming up. But essentially, if you're a scientist, the only way you could end up in court, or should be the only way you can end up in court, is if you're professionally negligent. Similarly to a doctor, if he examines a patient and misses something completely obvious in the patient, then he could be had out for negligence. If, however, he doesn't predict exactly when the patient will get a heart attack or something like that, then, you know, he's not being professionally negligent. So if one is using established scientific practice in doing one's risk assessments, then actually one should be fairly safe. The problem, as I said, arises is when, in a sense, too much is expected of you, and you're expected to also to make the decisions as to what should be done on behalf of those risks and communicate those.
There is a lot of pressure to, if not make those predictions, to offer greater certainty. For example, the area of climate science, floods and droughts, the spread of disease, there's an enormous amount of pressure on scientists to provide greater certainty. And as science edges towards being able to offer more accurate predictions, does that pressure increase?
There's always that pressure, and it's got to be really strongly stood up against. People, there's a demand for certainty. Everyone likes certainty. The policymakers, the people who are making the decisions, would love to be told exactly what's going to happen, and it has to be made really clear to them that we just can't say. Weather forecasting, we're getting pretty good up to about 5 days out. Beyond that, it gets more iffy, and much beyond that, and up to seasonal predictions, and we haven't got much clue at all. So I think it is a real problem, and that's why scientists must be absolutely rigorous and really make sure that their uncertainties, their caveats, are kept associated with their judgments and not get pushed into trying to be more certain.
If you do issue a public statement or a press release with too many caveats, you run the risk, though, of journalists or people who stand to be affected of doing nothing. How do you get that balance right?
Is very tricky, and this is where what's known as the precautionary approach tends to come into action. That, you know, how much do you say? Well, to be on the safe side, you could do X, Y, and Z. And then you are leaving it up to people to say. Some people are more cautious, more anxious, and they can do something. Other people say, I'm not going to bother. And essentially, you leave it up to them. Now, of course, if things are really imminent, you can't leave it up to people. You have to do compulsory evacuations if necessary, under volcanoes or whatever. But if it really is a bit iffy, then it seems quite reasonable to give precautionary advice and to leave it up to individuals.
Now, you mentioned the importance of scientists being able to communicate their work well to the public and convey the probabilities of an outcome. Now, what's at issue in this Italian case isn't the research, it's what people were told about the research.
Yeah.
And it was contained by one of the accused who gave a TV interview trying to summarise the findings in a way that conveyed that there wasn't perhaps a risk. So it's problematic no matter who's conveying the information, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. I mean, for what I understand, that this one person gave an interview separate from the others, and the others are accusing him of misrepresenting some of the evidence. So they're also arguing within themselves about who was to blame for this. And it just shows a real difficulty that one person using terms, you know, things look favourable or whatever terms they used, just a single use of a word can cause real problems.
How will the outcome of this case be watched by scientists like yourself engaged in prediction science around the world?
Oh, I think very carefully. I think this is going to really call attention to the real care that's needed in organising any sort of risk assessment, management and communication procedure. People are going to be watching this very closely indeed.
Back in L'Aquila, Vincenzo Vittorini says the legal action won't end with the scientist's trial. Relatives of quake victims are also preparing to file charges against government officials for failing to impose or enforce earthquake-proof building codes in Abruzzo.
It's not a matter of blaming someone. The question is that someone has to take the responsibility if something hasn't been done the right way. Maybe in other countries of the world there is the ability of people in positions of power to take responsibility and to say sorry when someone gets something wrong. Because mistakes, we all make them, we can all make them. The thing in Italy, and it's wrong, is not to apologise because there's an arrogance which allows people to get away with anything. It's clear that the natural event, the earthquake, would not have caused deaths if the homes had been quake-proof, for example. We think that responsibilities aren't just of the High Risk Committee, but also of the local authorities, those who administered L'Aquila, because L'Aquila has always been categorised as an earthquake area too, which allows these types of buildings, not fully quake-proof, but with an inferior level of safety.
And, well, no one at an institutional level has placed L'Aquila on level one. Straight after the earthquake, we found out that L'Aquila is, in Italy, the area of greatest earthquake risk. So here it's not about revenge. There's no vendetta. There is a decision to make these people change their outlook, the outlook of the entire country, because, I repeat, it's unpleasant to understand these things only afterwards. It's unpleasant that we get it only after state funerals. The state, if it cares about its citizens, should try to intervene before.
That report by Corinne Podger in Radio National Melbourne with James Panichi, co-producer.